Good morning. Even though Bruce isn't here, I know you wanted to hear those words. It's good to see each one of you here. We have a beautiful day that the Lord has blessed us with. It's cooler. I'm very thankful for even that little bit of drop in temperature, but it's such a refreshing time of the year that was coming up upon us that it will be a little more pleasant outside, but that's just doesn't really matter ultimately. We are here to worship and serve God. Bruce has been out. I'm not sure where he is today. I know he's supposed to be here tonight. At least that's my understanding. He contacted me by text Wednesday night, I think it was. And I don't know why he has my phone number in there with a 1 in front of it. He still thinks he has to dial 1 with a cell phone to get a hold of me. But it doesn't come across with his name in it. It comes across just as a number, which I've got to interpolate. Okay, who is that? But whenever it says, hey, would you take the class for me Sunday morning? There's not a lot of people that'll call and ask that question except for Bruce. And so I reluctantly said, yes, I will. No, I'm happy to at least help. Turn, if you will, to the book of 1 Samuel. We're going to focus on chapter 7, but I want to go back and set the stage for what happens there and why. In my daily readings, you know, whenever you're reading in a program to try to finish the Bible in a year, you don't always read full messages. You'll read several chapters here, then several chapters here, and they may all be consecutive, but one night to the next or whatever time it is, you tend to lose focus on what is going in one thing. And there's something that's said in the 7th chapter that I really want to focus on. But I want to go back and set the stage for what has happened previously. And those of you that may remember, a few years ago, about 4 years ago, we were studying in the book of 1 Samuel. So we have some idea, and most people have generally remember that Samuel was the son of Elkanah and Hannah. And he was the product of prayer. That Hannah wanted a son, and she promised the Lord that if he would give her a male child, what would she do? Give him back to the Lord for all of his life. And as I was preparing this, it also helped me lead into other things that we need to focus on. And one of them is promise. She swore a promise to the Lord. I mean, this was directly to the Lord, not a promise to somebody else, but a promise to God that if you will give me a child, he will be yours all of his life. And she even promised that he would be a Nazarite, that no razor would come upon his head. And God answered her prayer. And Eli told her, you will get your prayer. You will get your request. She took that promise seriously because she ultimately did that. She brought Samuel whenever she had weaned him and gave him to Eli. And the words that were used at that time, I have lent him back to the Lord. So she gave him to God for God's purpose. And there's two things. One is that when we make a promise, we don't tend to focus as much on what promises mean, seem like today, as we should. But a promise made to God is something that should be kept. In Deuteronomy 30 and verse 2, and in Numbers 30 and verse 2, and also in Deuteronomy 23, God stresses that a promise made to him must be kept. And if it's not, let's look at Deuteronomy 23 right quick. In verse 21. He says, when thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord, to the Lord thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it, for the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee. God says, if you vow a vow to me, and you don't keep it, that's sin. You have transgressed the word. Now, I don't think that applies just to vows to God. If we make promises to people, that we need to keep those promises. And the Lord talks about that. Let your
word be your word.
You know, whatever you say, let that be what you're going to do. And we should. But Hannah did that, and she was blessed with that son. And she did what she had said that she would do. She took him and gave him back to him. And the second chapter of 1 Samuel, we notice there that the sons of Eli, and you don't have to go back. You can follow with me, but we're not going to hit each verse at all. We can't do that. But remember his sons, they were referred to as sons of Belial. It says they knew not the Lord. They also would take, when people came to make their offerings, they would take part of that was in the pot seething with a flesh hook, and they would take theirs out first. The Lord had said, you will take what a certain portion would be yours. And they took more than that. They took it from the people. They also took the fat, or the good part, before the Lord got his part. They placed themselves above God in things. And this was one of the sins that they were guilty of. And what I'm setting up is what happens to Israel a little bit later. They also would lie with the women that came and gathered at the door of the tabernacle. So here we are, we have two men. These were priests. Eli was the high priest. They were priests under him. And these were wicked men. So wicked that God punished them and Eli for their wickedness. He tells Eli that their sons, he sends a prophet to him. And he says, your sons will die on the same day. He said, because you restrained them not, you knew what they were doing, and you restrained them not, that they would die. And that did happen in a few chapters a little bit later. He said, he was going to do this to Eli, quote, because his sons had made themselves vile, and he restrained them not. Eli had a responsibility. Here Eli was the high priest. And even though his sons were grown, we're talking about men who were serving as priests, these were the men that took the Ark of the Covenant out to battle in the battle up around Shiloh here shortly. Men who knew what the Word of God was, knew what their responsibilities were, and did not do them. And God tells Eli, you didn't discipline your sons. Now, I think that probably goes back a long ways, because they probably weren't instructed as they should have been. But it made me think, even as an adult, Eli should have done something with those sons. Now, he did talk to them. I had to go over here and find a particular spot. And he says in chapter 2, he said unto them, because it says here in verse 22, and Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto Israel, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil doings by all the people. Nay, my sons, it is no good report that I hear, that you make the Lord's people to transgress. And he goes on to say, if one man sins against another, and the judge shall judge him, that the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against the Lord, who shall entreat for him? Notwithstanding, they hearken not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them. That don't mean that they did it because the Lord was going to slay them. The Lord slew them because they did not hearken to their father. But a pronouncement was also made on Eli. And the Lord, through a prophet, told Eli, you will not have an old man in your family from now on. And, of course, that is something that the Israelites loved, had their heritage. It went on. But Eli's place in the hierarchy of priests was supplanted by somebody else. And his family did not continue in that role. And that's a disgrace. It was a disgrace to Eli. But he paid for what his sons did do and didn't do. And it made me think that even in the church today, we have elders. Those elders watch for our souls. And they have a responsibility to God and to us. If we're in sin, to come to us. In fact, that's not just their responsibility. That's every Christian's responsibility. To try to change us. But if they don't do their responsibility, they will be held accountable just like Eli was. But that goes for whether it be elders, deacons, preachers, teachers, any saint. The work of the Lord is important. And God expects His leaders, He expects all of His people, I shouldn't say just His leaders, to be holy people. And when you look at what happened to Eli and to his sons, and what's going to happen in the battle that's going to take place in the next couple of chapters, Israel was sinning. This was part of it. This wasn't their only problem. And we'll see that later in chapter 7. It wasn't their only problem, at least the sons of Eli weren't. But sure enough, they go out, they take the Ark of the Covenant. They're told to bring it out to the battle that was going on outside of Shiloh against the Philistines. And do you remember what happened whenever it came into the congregation? What did the children of Israel do? They shouted. It was joyful. Because to see the Ark of the Covenant, which represented the presence of God to come, God was with them, or at least they thought He was. And even the Philistines could hear the shout and said, they were afraid. But one of them said, no, we've got to press on. We've got to do this. And sure enough, they took Israel. They defeated Israel. They took the Ark of the Covenant. Eli's sons both died that day in that battle. And when word came back to Eli, the man came and told him how the battle had gone, that the Ark of the Covenant was captured. And then he said, oh, also, by the way, your sons are dead. What happened to Eli? You remember? He was sitting on a stool of some sort and he fell off and broke his neck and died. And it wasn't because it said when he heard about his sons, this happened. His heart was there for the Lord, but not in controlling his sons. We as fathers and you as mothers, we have responsibilities, you know, when our children are with us, definitely, to take care of them. Yes, Alan. And I agree with you. I thought I had said that, you know, that. But we don't have any, you know, nothing says that. But you're right. This wasn't something that those men just turned evil overnight. This was something that Eli hadn't disciplined those sons. And he also, had it been somebody else. Now, think what the law said. If you were taken in fornication, there was a penalty for that. What were his sons doing? Committing adultery, at least, if they're laying with women, because at least one of them had a child that was born right after his father died. I forget whether it was Hophni or Phinehas. There was a penalty for that. And Eli should have at least dealt with that. He hadn't done the right things up to that point in time. And here he was not doing it here. So Israel suffered because of the leadership being corrupt and because of the priesthood being corrupt, which priesthood is the leadership. And as a result of the ark being taken, what does that now represent for Israel? That God's not with them. Okay, let's continue on. But thank you, Alan. I appreciate that. I may not have made that as plain as I wanted to. I do the same thing. The Philistines took the ark in chapter 5, and immediately it caused problems for them. They were smitten with emerods. They were smitten with mice. And they tried, whatever town it came into, those men suffered because of that. And it says at one point, and I never could find where it actually happened, but it says, because they looked into the ark. The things in the ark were holy. These were things that I don't think even Israel was allowed to look into. When it was brought in and placed into the most holy place, nobody could go in there but the high priest. And that was only one time a year. To look upon the articles in the ark was something probably totally different, very holy. But when these men violated the law of God, not even knowing that, God smelt them with problems. And it was that as they came into one city, they'd have those problems, and so they'd send it to another city, and if this kept going on, the cities are starting to say, no, we don't want it. Don't bring it to us. And one of them, so they got their priests together, and what did one of their priests decide? Send it back to them. Let them deal with it. And in chapter 6, we find the story there where the priest says, look, put it on a cart, take two milk cows that have calves, lock the calves up, hook them to the cart, and let it go. And then we'll find out if this is from their God, if this is God doing this, or is this just happenstance? Of course, we know what happened to the cows. It says they went straight down the highway, turning neither to the right nor to the left. They followed the path that God sent them back to. It went to back to Beth Shemesh. Yes, sir? No. No, you can go ahead and do that for me. Not for me necessarily. But. Yeah, I think you're right. And I remember we had one cow that, or did we have two? Off and on, as I was growing up, we had a cow or two that gave milk. And Daddy did most of the milking, but he was out of the country for a while, and I ended up doing part of it, which was interesting to say the least. But I understand that, you know, that cows would reserve the cream when you're milking for the calves. And so it would come, you know, later in the process. And I could have it all backwards. I don't know. I'm like Alan. I dealt with it a little bit, but I didn't deal with it very much. But what Alan said, I think, is true. Here you have animals that have calves that they're caring for. And by nature, that's what they want to do is provide for those. And whenever those calves were lowing or making their sounds, those cows would want to come back. But the Spirit of God being upon those cows and them going straight to where God wanted them to go was very definitely the sign that, you know, those calves are here making their noise. The cattle are lowing, indicating that they really would like to go back, but they're not going back. And it wasn't that they wandered like this back and forth. They went down the highway, it says, straight, turning either to the right or to the left. Definitely. Definitely showing that it was the hand of God. You know, that was smart on their part, like Alan said, to do that. But they did some things that really weren't all that smart. One was looking in the ark. And secondly, they said, we have to send a gift to their God. And what gift did they send? Do you remember? It was golden. Yeah. Objects of the emeralds and five of the emeralds and five of the mice, if I remember correctly. And put those with the ark and send it back. They got the ark back. They got the cattle. What did Israel do with the cattle when they got them? Do you remember? They sacrificed them. They took the cart, made a fire, and sacrificed the cattle to God. So the cattle never got to do what they were to, but at God's point, that's what they were used for. So the ark ends up at Beth Shemesh. Beth Shemesh was one of the cities whenever they were allotting cities to the Israelites that was given to the sons of Aaron. And that is seen in 1 Chronicles. When you talk about the sons of Aaron, and I think this bears part, at least to some extent, on the lesson here, who are you talking about? Now you have the Levites. Aaron was of the Levites. So what would we refer to as the sons of Aaron? Who came from that group of people? The priest, not just the high priest. The high priest came from one particular lineage within that. But then you had the priest. So what you have in Beth Shemesh, and as you had spread throughout Israel, were the priests were scattered all about the city, all about the country to help. And they were in Beth Shemesh. That's where the cows went back to. Now, in chapter 7, or at the end of chapter 6, the very last verse there, we're going to start talking about another city called Kirjath-Jearim. And if you can say that better than me, go right ahead, because that's the best I can come up with. Which was about 20 to 25 miles as I could look on a map and gauge it. So it wasn't very far from where the priests were. And it may have even been a city of theirs. I couldn't determine that. I thought at first it was, but couldn't necessarily determine that. But when the cow came to Beth Shemesh, though, they sent word. Look at what it says in verse 21 of chapter 6. And they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have brought again the ark of the Lord. Come ye down and fetch it up to you." So that would tell me, and basically, and also in the next verse, "And the men of Kirjath-Jearim came and fetched up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab in the hill and sanctified Eleazar his son to keep the ark of the Lord." When you hear the name Eleazar, what does that bring up? Wasn't one of Aaron's sons Eleazar? Priest. I would think that this man was probably a priest as well. And he was sanctified, he was cleansed, he was made in God's eyes to be able to take that ark and to provide for it and to care for it. How long was that ark in Kirjath, whatever that place is? Was there a long time? 20 years. 20 years. And it says, "And it came to pass while it abode in Kirjath-Jearim, that it was a long time. It was there a long time, for it was 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented for the Lord." Where was the tabernacle at the time that Eli was living? It's evident that it was at Shiloh. That's where, and I've read that you can even find. At that point they had settled the land of Israel. It was no longer a tabernacle that they carried and wandered around with like they did as they were in the days of wandering in the wilderness. But it was stationed at Shiloh for some long period of time. But now you have the ark is no longer in the tabernacle. It's now outside of that where God had intended that it be. And Israel lamented for the Lord. The Lord was not in his proper place as far as they were concerned. And they were right. He wasn't in their hearts. He wasn't in their hearts. And they lamented after that. And that word, bewailed. They cried about it. They worried about it. But that's right. At that point in time, that was all they were doing. In verse 3 it says, "And Samuel spoke to the house of Israel, saying, If you will return to the Lord with all your hearts, and put away the strange gods and the Asheroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve Him only, and He will deliver you out of the hands of the Philistines." And look what it says in verse 4. "Then the children of Israel did put away the Baalim and the Asheroth, and serve the Lord only." Eli and his sons weren't the only problem. The biggest problem that Israel had, it seemed like, over the years was idolatry. and they would leave God and serve idols, and they would print and come back and so forth. This was back and forth during the period, especially during the period of the judges. But it says they, at this point, he got them to give up those gods and to turn and worship the Lord only. And Samuel said in verse 5, "Gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray for you. I will pray for you unto the Lord." And they gathered together to Mizpah. And here's the phrase that, if you take it by itself, doesn't make any sense. At least, I mean, it makes you go, what? What happened? And look what it says here. "And they gathered together at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord." They gather water, they get wherever it's coming from, whether it comes from springs or wells or whatever, but they gather water up and just intentionally pour it out on the ground. Now, just as a passerby, does that make sense? It doesn't to me. I mean, as I read through this, in my smartphone, I got some notes and I put things in it. I wanted to go back and look at this, maybe for a possible class, which is what you're getting today. What's going on there? Because it goes on and says, "They poured out the water before the Lord and fasted on that day and said, 'We have sinned against the Lord.' And Samuel judged the children of Israel at Mizpah." What is the meaning of gathering the water and pouring it out before the Lord? Anybody want to take a shot? I'm not catching you off guard. I know that. It is apparently an outward expression of what they were feeling inside. There are several places, and it says that one of the Chaldean different cultures have taken the scriptures and put them into theirs and their wordings, and the Chaldeans apparently did the same thing. Because it says that a Chaldean paraphrasation of it says, "They poured out their heart like water in penitence before the Lord." Let's look at some verses. Psalm 62 and verse 8. Todd, do you mind that one? Psalms 34 and 18. Mr. Binko? There's a few more. And Psalms 51 and 17. Alan, if you don't mind. Okay, Todd, go ahead. Psalm 62 and 8. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mike? Right. And Alan? What is Israel doing here? Israel has been shown that, first of all, you're in sin. God is no longer with you. Y'all lost the battle. You've lost the Ark of the Covenant. You finally got it back, but it no longer can be in His house. God is not happy. And Samuel says to him what? Told him to turn. Let's go back and look over there. He says, "Prepare your..." Go back over here, verse 3. "He spake unto them and said, 'If you do return unto the Lord with all of your heart.'" That's the first thing. It's not just an outward deal of saying, okay, We won't serve God. Well, you haven't been serving God. Your heart's not right before God. He said, turn to the Lord with all your hearts and put away the strange gods and prepare your hearts to serve God. And what kind of heart, based on what we read, has to have? A broken spirit and a contrite heart. That hasn't changed. That hasn't changed. God demands the same thing of us. God knows all about us. And I'm not telling you anything new. I know that. But when God looks at our hearts, what does He see? Are we contrite? Do we mourn for our sins? What was one of the first Beatitudes? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who know that they are poor spiritually before God. And that can be any time in our lives. Definitely before we become Christians. And if we're not careful, it can be afterwards. We don't let Him fall. We take Him from the place that He should have in our heart and replace it with something else. A broken and contrite heart. There's some other things that were said. Lamentations 2 says, "Arise, cry out in the night, in the beginning of the watches. Pour out your heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift up your hands toward Him for the life of thy young people that faint for hunger in the top of every street." Pour out your heart before God. We need to do that. Let's continue on. There's something a little bit later that I couldn't find it in the song book, but we do sing about it from time to time. It said in verse 7, and when it said, well, Samuel judged Israel in verse 6, and it says, "When the Philistines heard that the children of Israel were gathered together at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel, and when the children of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines." Look, they had just been defeated by the Philistines I don't know how long this is after that battle. Samuel was one of his first, I think, battles. And so I don't know. I don't know how long it stayed with the Philistines. The ark, that is. But they were afraid. And the children of Israel said to Samuel, "Cease not to cry unto the Lord our God for us, that He will save us out of the hands of the Philistines." They realized that they needed help. Here they turn to a holy man, a man of God named Samuel, and say, "Don't stop praying for us. Try. Keep trying." And it says in verse 10 that Samuel was offering up the burnt offerings, that as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to the battle against Israel, but the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day, and the Philistines were upon the Philistines and discomfited them, and they were smitten before Israel. And the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and smote them until they came to under Bethcar. Here's a group of men, the family of Israel, that had been afraid of the Philistines, had lost to the Philistines, had lost the ark. Whenever they've turned to God with all of their heart, and they've told Samuel, "You pray for us." Samuel prayed for them. Who else prayed for his people, for God's people? Some of them before this, maybe even after this. Didn't Moses pray for Israel? God wanted to destroy Israel because of their sin. And He told Moses, "Step aside. I'm going to destroy them all and I'll start all over with you." God besought Moses besought God for 40 days. Did it twice. Trying to get them, God, to relent and not destroy them. Elijah. James talks about the fact that Elijah was a man and he prayed. But when you go back and you read the story of Elijah when he did that, God had told him, "You pray. I'm going to send rain." But did it happen at the first prayer? No. I think it was like three. I didn't go back and look, but something like three times. So it's not a matter of I'm going to go to God in prayer and I'm going to make this one prayer and that's going to be fine. That may be. But we're not to be of that attitude. We need to continue praying and realize that our help comes from God. Verse 12, and Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shin, and called on the name and called it by the name Ebenezer, saying, hitherto hath the Lord helped us. There's a song we sing, and I could not find what the number it was, Todd. Here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I've come. Did you ever wonder where that came from? Right here. The Ebenezer stone was set up. And what did it show Israel? Whenever Israel would come back to that stone as they would go through their wanderings, whenever you come upon that stone, what would you think? Ah, this is that time. That with Samuel's help, people turned back to the Lord and got the help from the Lord that they needed. Because it says there, hitherto hath the Lord helped us. If you go look up the word Ebenezer in... I'm sorry? Okay, that's the one. O thou fount of every blessing, tune thy heart to sing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. I'll get all the words wrong if I'm not careful. Well, you can thank me for that, okay? But that's, you know, our songs are written for reasons. And they tell stories, they tell events, but they're to help us. And whenever we sing, if you sing a song and you find a reference there or even a word that you wonder, what is that? Why did that writer of that song put that in there? There's a reason for it. Songs are to lift us up. I think they can even make us feel, you know, contrition when we think what God has done for us. And I drove on, I guess I was by myself going to Memphis over to see the kids once and listened to some CDs, you know, of a cappella music. And it's just like, man, it's awesome. We serve an awesome God. And as He was there to help Israel, He's there to help us. I'm not going to do you like Bruce. I've got 5 minutes and I'm not going to use them. I asked Sammy before class. I understand that Sammy's going to bring the lesson the next hour that he could take my time if he wanted to. He said, what? Couldn't I? I said, I'm before you. He said, oh, you want to trade? I said, no. Why don't you take both of them? He declined. But I hope you've gained something from the lesson today. It can be beneficial to us because we see that the things written before time were written for our learning. And look at what God did for His people and look at what because He can do the same thing for us, and He will if we'll let Him. Any comments or questions? I appreciate the comments that we've had. Thank you very much.